The time is now. Volume 8, Episode 144. This is Employment Law Now. I am Mike Schmidt, the host of this podcast and the Vice Chair of Labor and Employment here at Cozen O'Connor. So, what's the latest on regulation of artificial intelligence? We're going to take a little bit of a break from all of the discussion and all of the preliminary analysis of all of the federal agency regulation and guidance and rulings over the past couple of weeks to bring back a discussion and a topic that has really dominated much of the past several months and really the past year, artificial intelligence. So what is the latest when it comes to the regulatory climate of AI? What should employers be thinking about right now? Let's get into it. I am so happy to have Jeff Clement here with us to talk about AI on a little break here from all of the federal agency regulations and guidance and rules that we've been talking a lot about the last couple of weeks. Jeff is a terrific colleague of ours here at Cozen O'Connor in our labor and employment department. He has spent his entire career in private practice and in-house, and he's devoted a good part of his most recent years advising clients on all things AI, where he's also had firsthand experience developing large language AI models and driving cutting edge AI solutions for our firm itself and for our firm clients. Jeff, so happy that you are joining us.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here with you.
So I guess let's start off talking a little bit about your experience with AI and what got you interested in AI in the first place.
Sure. Well, my journey into AI was made possible only through my experience as an employment lawyer. I worked as an employment litigator for about 10 years and then made the move in-house to a multinational company that does a lot of work in the automation space. And I'm from a family of engineers, so I immediately sort of shrugged all of that technical stuff off at first. But over time, I found it pretty interesting to learn about. And eventually, I took an in-house position at a driverless car company. And this was life-changing for me, is just being able to see how artificial intelligence can be used to perform sort of human-like functions in the real world, and also just really increase accessibility in a way that was never possible before. So from there, I started working directly with large language models, as you mentioned, and that was in the generative AI space as a contractor. I was working to help train them process, perform, and respond like lawyers. And now I'm back full circle at a law firm, but with some of the experience and insight into the technology that I'm hoping to use to benefit our industry.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And when we talk about AI, I do want to level set with the terms and the buckets we're talking about. There are some people who are listening to the podcast who are real deep into AI and all of the lingo, and there are still some people who, maybe dipping a toe in the pool a little bit, but still not as familiar. From a real 30,000-foot level, there's generally two buckets that we talk about, AI and generative AI, correct?
Yeah, so zooming all the way out, AI is often split into two buckets, as you said. So first, there's what I like to call discriminative AI, which is sort of a scary-sounding thing to mention on an employment law podcast, but that is an actual term, and discriminative AI refers to the practice of using AI to make distinctions. So it's what song is playing in the background at that restaurant, or what species of bird did you capture in that photo on your phone? And that type of AI has been around for a long time. In the other bucket, though, we have generative AI, and that's about producing. So write me song lyrics or create that picture of the bird. And generative AI is newer to the scene. And while people have been working on it for a long time, it's often recognized as emerging sort of globally in 2022, late in the year.
And so, how do you distinguish AI from less intelligent automation functions?
Sure. Well, this gets into sort of a much larger debate about how to define AI. And from my perspective, which is not very technical, but what I think is unique about artificial intelligence systems is that they use something called deep learning. And that's a phrase that's going to be important in law and everywhere. And deep learning is a type of machine learning that stacks like layers of algorithms in a way that aspires to emulate the neural networks of the human brain. So information can flow through the stacks and it can be used to make really sophisticated statistical predictions about any type of data. So for example, in an autocorrect situation, it could be ranking how often each word would appear in a given context. And when this type of learning is applied to language, it can be used with a lot of other types of algorithms and models to begin to interpret and understand language. And that gets to what we call natural language processing, which is a term I think, many of us have heard of. But with that, AI can not only rank those words, it can also understand like where they would fit in a sentence and should be applied. And that leads us to these large language models and the GPT function, which is, ubiquitous in our society today.
Yeah, and so a lot of people have heard of ChatGPT. We know what chat means. What's the GPT part of that?
Sure. The GPT stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer. And in the most basic sense, it takes that deep learning technology that I just mentioned, and it uses it to train an entire architecture that transforms what is essentially statistical data into a human-like understanding of language with the ability to generate and analyze text and other communicative expressions.
So in some form or another, we've been using AI, quite a bit before all of the buzz and all of the new regulation, which we're going to talk about in a second. Just things such as autocorrect, things like that. I mean, that is a
Right.
form of AI, right?
That is, and even a lot of types of autocorrects are going to use AI that involves that deep learning process I mentioned. And that's why I think deep learning, especially when we get into discussions about deep fakes, which that's where the word deep is migrated from, that's why that phrase I think is really important now and will continue to be in the future.
Yeah, so coming back to, I guess, where we wanted to go with this is the impact on employers. I mean, there's a lot to unravel here when you talk about AI and generative AI just generally. But we want to talk a little bit about employers and what employers should be thinking about. And so what I really wanted to go through with you is a lay of the land and the current lay of the land in regulation in this space. And I'm curious about this sort of race to be proactive. It seems like other countries, particularly those in the European Union, the EU, are a few steps ahead of the US when it comes to addressing the potential risks of AI and more substantive regulation. Is that a fair assessment? And if yes, why do you think it is?
I think that's fair. And as a governing body, the EU is further ahead than the US on this topic, if for no other reason than it has passed a legislative framework for its member states. So the US has addressed AI only through an executive order and executive branch regulations at the federal level. But there's no centralized legislation from Congress or anything like that that equals what exists in the EU. There are certain states that are starting to enact AI legislation, however.
Yeah, and I'll get to the states and the US side of this. Just to finish off the point about the EU, just last month on March 13th, 2024, the European Parliament officially adopted the landmark EU Artificial Intelligence Act, which appears to be the world's first standalone law dedicated to AI. The AI Act, as it's referred to, takes a risk-based approach to the regulatory scheme. Beyond that, what generally does the EU's AI Act do?
Sure. Well, there's so much to the EU AI Act, and it really is the world's first comprehensive framework for AI regulation. So any business that is involved in providing or even using an AI system that touches the EU really needs to be aware of this act. And as you mentioned, it categorizes AI systems according to risks and regulates them accordingly. So there are four risk groups. It's unacceptable risk, high risk, limited risk, and minimal risk.
And so just in terms of coverage, this does not only apply, say, to an employer or organization that's physically within the EU. You can have a U.S. company, for example, and maybe you have employees or some office facility location within the EU, and this would apply to you.
Sure, it could apply if you have a office in the EU, but it can also apply if you are using EU in the context of a client's supply chain. And in that context, you know, you could be using and deploying AI in a way that touches people in the EU. And if it's doing that, you really need to take a look at where your usage falls within this risk-based structure to understand your obligations under the Act.
So let's go through the four risks one by one, because I think this is important for those who are clearly within the EU and subject to the Act, but also, as you just pointed out, a whole lot of other organizations and employers that might not have thought they were may be. So let's take your four risks and start off with the unacceptable risk category. What are those?
Okay, so the AI systems with unacceptable risks are the ones that are prohibited in the EU. And this will start 6 months after the Act's entry into force, which, by the way, has not happened yet, but will be coming. So this is, as I mentioned, a red line prohibition. And the prohibited systems are those that are involved in exploitation of vulnerable populations, that engage in social scoring of people, that conduct emotion recognition in the workplace or educational institutions, that use biometric information to infer sensitive data, such as sexual orientation, religion, or union membership. And just a note on that, you may be wondering how biometric information can do that. The Act defines that to include behavioral patterns, right? So that's one of the reasons that's a prohibited usage. It also includes technologies and AI that use subliminal techniques to manipulate people's behavior. And there's also some limitations on law enforcement with respect to predictive policing and facial recognition, and additional prohibitions on facial image scraping from, like, the internet, from Facebook, for example, or closed caption television footage.
Yeah, and I hope people are not sort of glazing over yet with this discussion about the EU, because we're going to get to the regulation and the current state of the land in the U.S., but I do think for context purposes and for the complete picture, it's important to talk about what the EU is doing, if for no other reason, that a lot of this may migrate its way to U.S. regulation.
Right. And we've seen that before already with the GDPR and privacy regulations that have emanated from the EU, and how they've really had a global impact, you know, including on many U.S. companies.
That's a great point. All right. So that was the unacceptable risk category. The next level of risk deals with high risk AI systems. What are those?
So these are the systems that present really important risks to rights or safety concerns, but they're risks that the EU deems can be mitigated with adequate safeguards. So these include the systems that use AI in critical infrastructure. So, for example, roads, railroads, water systems, systems that use AI in lawful biometric identification systems. So that could include, you know, general emotion recognition, as long as it's not in the workplace or in educational context. It's systems that use AI in educational training, such as aptitude tests or admissions decisions, discipline decisions, systems that use AI to access essential public and private services. So this gets into the healthcare administration, lines of credit and emergency services, also AI in certain types of immigration and law enforcement, This is including systems that use AI in justice administration, and that includes systems used by or to assist judicial authorities for researching and interpreting facts. So we'll have to see how that is interpreted and plays out in our world, in the legal world. This high-risk systems include systems for influencing voting behaviors and election outcomes. And
big
last
topic,
but not least,
topic these days.
Yes, exactly. And I saved the best for last, Mike. It's employment. So high-risk systems include systems that can influence employment decisions or anything like job advertisements, recruitment, like filtering and evaluating candidates, as well as making employment-related decisions, decisions and work assignments, promotions, terminations, you name it. So sort of an all-in-one risk characterization for employment law decisions.
And a large part of the EU's AI Act regulations actually deal with these high-risk systems that you just identified.
That's correct. The Act requires a variety of AI governance measures and technical interventions for high-risk systems. These include registration, human rights impact assessments prior to deployment. So that's a big deal. Quality management through the entire life cycle of the system. So that's while you're implementing the system, but also after you sell the system and after, you know, once you're using the system. It includes design capabilities that allow for human oversight and appropriate levels of accuracy. So it has to be correct to a degree, and a system for certifying conformity with these standards so that you can actually be on the market as a product that conforms with standards.
And this is where we start really picking up from a regulatory standpoint. When you mentioned a few minutes ago, when you talk about the supply chain and the AI value chain, how do these regulations, how does this AI Act apply to that?
So if you're a developer, first of all, of a high-risk AI system in the EU, everything I just mentioned will apply to you. But I think what might get lost is that importers and distributors and other entities in that value chain all have obligations as well. And if you're using AI, and you know, you might be what the Act calls a deployer, and we've been saying users, but a deployer is someone that uses AI systems within the EU or outside of the EU, as long as the output touches the EU. So, for example, you may be in the US and using an AI system to evaluate European offices for a worldwide incentive program, and that's going to be considered a high-risk activity if that data is affecting employees in the EU. So deployers cannot engage in any prohibited use cases. They must assign human oversight to competent people. So these are people who must be trained. Employers need to monitor the use, ensure prompts or input data is relevant and tailored to the intended purpose of the high-risk system. So we're not going and putting all sorts of unnecessary personal or confidential information and prompts for these decisions. And employers are going to have reporting obligations for certain incidents. So a lot of obligations come along with the usage of these high-risk systems.
All right, so that's the unacceptable risk category and then the high-risk category. The next two levels of the four that you identified are considered limited risk and minimal risk. That does not appear to be no risk. So what are we talking about with these last two, limited and minimal risk categories?
Sure. So limited risk systems are ones like chatbots, where maybe the end user is not aware they're not interacting with a human. So these types of limited risk systems are accompanied by transparency requirements. And there's a lot of different nitty-gritty requirements there, but generally it's about transparency at that level. And the minimal risk systems are systems that are more rote, like spam filters or video games. And these are thought not to pose any risk to human rights or really any type of decision making. So the Act says that these can be used freely, you know, within its context.
Without getting even more granular than we have been, what do you have to show in order to demonstrate that the AI system is one within the minimal risk bucket?
Sure. Well, it has to meet one of at least four criteria. So, to perform a narrow procedural task, to improve the result of a previously completed human activity, to detect decision-making patterns or deviations from prior decision-making patterns, and is not meant to replace or influence the previously completed human assignment. So it's really, you can see how it's really a separation from human thought and human decision making at this level. And the final is to perform a preparatory a task to an assessment that might be relevant for, one of the use cases that we've mentioned.
Is the EU Act an appropriate basis to model other regulation here in the US?
So I think there are many aspects of the act that could be effective in the US. And, this is just my opinion, but for me as an employment lawyer, there is a lot of appeal in having sort of a holistic starting point, right? That delineates employer obligations based on risk rather than a series of all these individual laws that might cover all the use cases we could think of. Which I suspect may happen here in the US if in the absence of some sort of comprehensive federal legislation. And I also think there's like a lot of intuitive appeal in this risk-based approach. And we've seen the US emulate that in certain respects. But in many other ways, I think the EU AI Act would be difficult for us to model here in the US. And the reason, first, I think, the act is sort of draped over this robust body of privacy and human rights regulations in the EU that we just don't have in the US. And we already mentioned GDPR, privacy regulation among that. And so, in my opinion, trying on the act would be kind of like trying on a shirt that's just too big, and I'm not sure it would be a good fit. The next reason is, the act really focuses on AI systems over general purpose AI models, which it does address, but it does that through sort of a separate systemic risk approach. And, general purpose AI models are becoming much more used and prevalent. And finally, the act doesn't really regulate private individuals' use of AI for personal purposes. But it can pose astronomical penalties on corporations, like up to 7% of global annual revenue in some cases. So I'm not sure that would pass scrutiny here. So I think what you end up with, just to summarize, is this great framework for preventing specific AI systems from abusing general human rights. But I'm not so sure you have a system for preventing specific humans from abusing general AI applications to the detriment of the public. And I wonder if AI will become so generalized and the use cases so limitless that it might make more sense to have a universal risk management framework across all systems and models rather than this sort of targeted approach that we're currently seeing.
Okay, so then bringing this all back then to AI regulation in the US, we have started to see, and you started to mention this, a sort of patchwork of attempts to regulate various practices attending to the development and use of AI. And I want to start on the federal side first here in the US. The Biden administration recently issued an executive order based on eight guiding principles. What are those guiding principles, and are they important?
Sure. The guiding principles are one, ensuring the safety and security of AI technology, two, promoting innovation and competition, three, supporting workers, four, advancing equity and civil rights, five, protecting consumers, patients, passengers, and students, six, protecting privacy, seven, advancing federal government use of AI, and eight, strengthening American leadership abroad. And to me, these principles are very important. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I one of them is that they largely align with the principles espoused in the blueprint for an AI Bill of Rights, which, is one of the early documents that the White House commissioned and really kind of mimics these. Well, it's the origination of these principles. And the principles that I just read really set the spirit, if not the stage, for federal AI legislation. So even if this, this is an executive order, right? So it may not last. It may be overturned or taken away or what have you. But even if it doesn't stand the test of time, I think these principles are important for what whatever may come afterwards.
And as an executive order, is it binding as law on all employers?
No, the executive order by itself binds the federal government and a few select private sector companies, but it's not binding on all employers. And there's really three groups of private sector companies that are bound. The first of these is companies that are developing large AI models that could pose a serious risk to security or national public health or safety. The second is entities and individuals that have large scale computing clusters. And the third is infrastructure as a service or IaaS providers, which are like the big cloud computing companies. The way that the EO, which is interesting, the way it actually binds these companies is through the Defense Production Act. And that's an act that authorizes certain executive powers to regulate threats to national security. So that's sort of the mechanism through which the EO extends to these private sector companies. And there are some other ways that other private sector companies may eventually be affected. So, for example, government contractors that sell, and we mentioned this, but, you know, the ones that sell or deploy AI in their services, they're inevitably going to be subject to the EO through either commercial pressures or just through general regulation. And other employers may be affected to the extent that they're subject to regulations from the federal agencies that have the directives under the executive order, like the Department of Labor.
Yes, let's get into the Department of Labor. If the executive order doesn't necessarily apply to all employers as binding law, and in many respects sort of sets the policy, starts the discussion, does the executive order at least require the enactment of new regulations in this area?
Yes, definitely. So the executive order calls on a number of federal agencies to execute over 100 action items. So that includes a lot of regulation. And, you know, a lot of the more technical stuff is going to fall on the Department of Commerce and its National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, which, if you haven't heard of before, is going to be a big player in this world. But the order also requires agencies to promulgate regulations to address things like bias and the use of AI. So Department of Labor is a prime example of that, right? So the order requires the OFCCP, the Office of Federal Contractor Compliance, to establish principles and best practices for employers to prevent discrimination. And that's likely going to affect, you know, all the contractors who are subject to the OFCCP. The DOL also has to establish compliance guidelines for employers that develop AI for workforce management purposes. And just very recently, on April 29th, we saw that the wage and hour division of the DOL touched on this in a bulletin that it released. It was about the Fair Labor Standards Act and some other federal requirements. The DOL has to report on how federal agencies can assist workers who are displaced by AI technology. And there's even considerations to revise immigration regulations to fast track the hiring of STEM workers. There's a bunch of other agencies that are also tasked with regulations. So these include the Department of Health and Human Services, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Department of Education and Housing and Urban Development. So we should expect to see a lot of studies, rules, regulations, and things of that nature coming through in the next few months and years.
Does the executive order itself set any new standards?
It does. So the executive order directs NIST, which I mentioned before, to create standards for developing, testing, and implementing AI technologies, as well as guidelines for much more technical solutions like authenticating synthetic AI and more things of that nature. But the EO also directly sets standards for those large AI models that I mentioned. So these include the need to report to the Department of Commerce on training and red team safety testing of the models, the owners of the key data, and the steps taken to protect that data. The large computing clusters, in turn, they have to inform the government of their existence, their location, and their size. And the IaaS companies must collect know your customer information from any foreign customers that might be using the cloud to train those large AI models. and they have to report that activity to the federal government.
You used a term a second ago when you said the need to report to Department of Commerce on red team safety testing. What do you mean by red team?
Sure. Red team is a word that we're going to hear a lot of, and thanks for asking. We're going to hear a lot of that in the future. And the EO defines that as a structured testing effort to find flaws and vulnerabilities in an AI system, often in a controlled environment and in a collaboration with developers of AI. So it's sort of a guided and holistic testing process that the executive order is calling for.
And the executive order really needs to be read along with the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB, their memo, Advancing Governance, Innovation, and Risk Management for Agency Use of Artificial Intelligence, which many of you may know was finalized recently on March 28th, 2024. That memo has a lot of hard accountability for agencies, which likely will flow down to private sector suppliers and contractors. Can you give a few examples of that?
Sure. And thanks for mentioning the memo, because I think the memo often gets lost in this conversation of the executive order. And this is where we're going to see a lot of the requirements that maybe private sector companies can expect to have to deal with just as suppliers and government contractors. So some of those hard accountability items include that agencies must, you know, they must either implement these what we call minimum procedures for what's called safety impacting and rights impacting AI. So this is where you might see some of the executive order kind of mimicking that risk-based approach that we saw in the EU AI Act, because you have to do this analysis of safety impacting, is it rights impacting? And if it is, you have to implement minimum procedures that are spelled out in the OMB. Now, when I'm saying you, I'm talking about federal agencies, but that's the requirement. And what's the hard accountability is here, you either implement those minimum procedures or you don't use the technology. And this has to be done by December 1st of 2024. So really a very clear and effective mandate there. The memo also requires agencies to conduct impact assessments on the intended purposes and benefits of AI, the potential risks of AI, and the quality and appropriateness of the data that is going to be used in the AI. The agencies must test and independently evaluate the AI for performance in a real-world context. They have to conduct ongoing monitoring and regularly assess, mitigate risks. They have to provide training and human oversight. So the human oversight thing is, again, another very common theme. And one example that I heard about this, which is not mine, but I've heard it and I love it. It's the idea that, you know, you could be waiting in a line to get on a plane and the AI is not recognizing your face. There still has to be someone there that lets you get on the plane and so you don't miss your flight. So that's a good example of the human oversight. And finally, the OMB would require agencies to provide public notice and plain language documentation to people that would likely be affected by the use of AI in these systems.
You mentioned a term at the beginning of this discussion, deep fakes. So I appreciate you teasing that. So we keep folks listening to the entire episode here. We've also been hearing and reading a lot about this concept of deep fakes. What are deep fakes?
So deep fakes are thought of as synthetic media, which that's a term that we've mentioned. And it's synthetic media that uses deep learning techniques to mimic a person's image, likeness, or sound. So this could be, you know, a classic example is that image of the Pope, which I don't know if you've seen that, Mike, but it's this image of the Pope in the Vatican, and he's wearing an expensive white puffer jacket looking like a rock star. And that's a deepfake. That's not real for anyone who hasn't figured that out yet. But it looks so real. And the way it does that is using that deep learning, right, that we initially talked about, and being able to take very few elements of data and really extrapolate what they may look like, what they may sound like, and it can mimic any one of us. So deepfakes can obviously be very dangerous and nefarious. There's plenty of horror stories, as you mentioned, about people being conned out of money by videos of or panicked phone calls from people that looked or sounded just like someone that they thought they knew very, very well. So,
and people have been playing with technology and doing this type of stuff for years. It just seems that they've been able to do a better job at it and a better job of creating these deep fakes with these new models and these new AI systems.
That's right.
So going back to the executive order, does the Biden administration executive order actually address deepfakes?
It does. The executive order instructs the Commerce Department, again, this agency that houses NIST, to study ways to identify and mark synthetic content and also to authenticate content and sort of try to trace it back to its origin. It makes some calls for cybersecurity programs and certain studies that could include measures to protect against deepfakes. However, it really doesn't present what I would call a focused approach to deepfakes. And I think part of that is because the bad deepfakes, the con deepfakes, are not a problem that really can be easily legislated away. And you know, there's a lot of debate about whether things like marking synthetic content are even going to be effective, because you really have to consider how like bad actors might work around these requirements. They could forge the watermark, or they could remove the mark, whatever, you know, whatever the requirement is, they might be able to find a way to do the opposite.
So what are the takeaways that employers should know about the Biden administration executive order?
Well, first, I think it's important to think about the executive order as a first step in what's going to be a multi-year process of regulation. And
that may change also, you know, depending on the result of the election in November. I mean, we should be obviously aware of that.
Exactly. It's just an executive order. So it has the potential to be undone. And without federal legislation, it's just that. But if it lasts, the regulations generated by the order will touch nearly every industry. And companies that do business with the federal government are going to need to evaluate the impact of the order on them. Their use of AI is going to have to comply with those standards that the government sets for its own use. And they will likely be subject to specific compliance requirements, you know, that may apply to government contractors. Companies that are developing AI models are going to have to prepare for increased regulation, transparency, particularly with respect to the testing, the red teaming and training data. And then finally, for employers, our clients are going to have to review the use of AI algorithms in employment decision making. So resume screening, AI interviews, accommodations, and you know, we're really going to need to drill down on things like bias and auditing and those impact assessments that I mentioned.
Yeah, and it may be the understatement of the year when you just said that companies developing AI models, using AI models, should prepare for increased regulation, and that's going to be from all different points. You know, just let's go through a couple of examples here. The Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, which we've been talking about now in a whole different context, dealing with non-compete agreements, right, as recently as the last episode, and stay tuned for more on that. But I guess not surprisingly, the FTC has entered the artificial intelligence arena, right?
That's correct. And they've taken a very keen interest in AI. So there, you know, there's something called the Government and Business Impersonation Rule, which just became effective on April 1st. And what that does is it makes it an unlawful deceptive practice to materially and falsely pretend that you are or that you are affiliated with a government entity, a business, or an officer, either one of those, in the context of commerce, right? So what does that mean? Well, you know, it lets the FTC directly seek monetary relief in federal court from scammers. So scammers that may use government seals or business logos, and we've all seen this, right? Like in junk email and things of that nature. Scammers that would spoof government business emails and web addresses, including, you know, the .gov email address, or using lookalike addresses that, you know, maybe the ones that sort of misspell a company's name to trick people. That's all included. And it would cover scammers that falsely imply government or business affiliation by using terms that are known. So a good example of this is, you know, you get that phone call that says, "Hi, I'm calling from the clerk's office," you know, to imply that there's some sort of affiliation with the court when there isn't any. So that's what this rule is really about. But you can see how this also would apply to AI, because AI could take that type of prohibited conduct and really accelerate it just about everywhere. One thing I do want to point out, though, is the rule does not impact recreational or comedic impersonations. So your favorite television satire shows should be safe, hopefully.
So it's a sort of fair use kind of in the IP world. So exactly. Saturday Night Live is not going off anytime soon.
Let's hope.
At least for this reason. Yeah.
So there's a couple other things that the FTC is doing. So, you know, I just talked about the government and business impersonation. Right after that was released, there was issued a notice of supplemental notice of proposed rulemaking. And that was all about extending the government and business rule to individuals, because, you know, individuals don't want to be mimicked or spoofed either. So that's underway right now. I think the comment period is ending as we speak. And then, of course, on the traditional antitrust side, the FTC is issuing orders to many of the largest tech companies to get information about recent investments and partnerships involving generative AI and cloud services.
So that's the federal rundown. AI is clearly an issue where the state and local governments here in the U.S. have something to say as well. We've actually talked a bit on this podcast already about New York City's AI law, which relative to all this seems like it's been out for decades already. But have there been other recent state developments that may continue to serve as bellwethers for other states in the AI arena?
Yeah, and the New York City law, local law 144, that to me is fascinating because it really demonstrates the complexities of regulating in this area. So I know you've discussed it, but that law requires bias audits for certain systems that may play dominant roles in hiring and promotion decisions. But it's also been criticized for creating a loophole whereby humans can simply rubber stamp the system's output and remove themselves from the coverage of the law. So New York State has two bills, S7623 and A9315.
Both for those keeping score at home.
Yes, both still in committees. So these are not passed, but these would require broader and more detailed bias audits and transparency notice for AI tools. So sort of building off of the New York City law and trying to close that perceived loophole. The regulated tools would include job screening and candidate ranking software. And they also propose limiting tech-enabled surveillance of employers, which is not common in most of the state proposals we're seeing. So a pretty robust legislation proposed out of New York. The other states that have looked at similar legislation proposing how to regulate employers' use of AI, it's similar. It's by requiring impact assessments, bias audits, things of that nature. And they include California, Illinois, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Vermont, Washington. So definitely a lot to look out for. Now, all of these are still sort of under consideration. And there are states that have passed AI regulations, but so far those are laws that largely address AI in government or appropriations or elections.
And I think one of the takeaways here certainly is this is fast moving, and can expect a lot to continue to happen on the regulatory front. You know, putting a little crystal ball in front of you at the moment, I hate to put you on the spot, but I will. Are there any new AI laws or regulations that are on the horizon, say, in the next 6 to 12 months that you see actually being enacted?
Sure. And I think before addressing that fully, it's important to remember that the EU AI Act and the executive order, they're just at their infancy now. And so they're going to be generating additional laws and regulations in the next 6 to 12 months. Notably, those EU member states, they have to get working to prohibit, to ban those prohibited activities. So we're going to see a lot of legislation coming out of there. And the executive order, to the extent it survives, you know, there's regulations and things that may be promulgated under that order for a couple of years.
And with another term, you know, and if the Biden administration continues for another 4 years, we're likely to see even more coming out of the White House.
Definitely. And it goes back to those principles. I mean, I think, and I may be over, I just am a big believer in those, but I think those are going to sort of guide, you know, each one of those is going to generate its own world of legislation, and at least in the U.S. But beyond that, our neighbors in Canada have been working on Artificial Intelligence Data Act, or ADA, as part of the Digital Charter Implementation Act. And some version of this is likely to be passed in the near future. So ADA is intended to ensure that AI systems deployed in Canada are safe and non-discriminatory, largely by holding businesses accountable for how they develop and use these technologies. But it also takes a stab at a general use case prohibition, which is prohibiting reckless and malicious uses of AI. So sort of an additional user end type of regulation. And it definitely imports some of what we see in the EU AI Act by attempting to ensure that high impact systems meet safety standards and human rights standards.
And, you know, we say a lot, who knows what Congress is going to be able to do between now and the election, if anything. But are there any bills sitting in Congress right now that employers should be watching for?
Yeah, there are a couple that I think are worthy of mention here. And one, I love the title of this one, but it's the No Robot Bosses Act, right? And so,
which is weird because normally, like you just said with ADA, usually you name a law with some letters that you can pronounce it easily.
Right.
I don't know what you do with NRBA, NERBA? Is this NERBA? Is that what this is going to be? I don't know. But you're right. The No Robot Bosses Act is a great one.
Yeah, so get those Robot Bosses Act, you know, get those robot bosses out of here, I guess is what the bill should say. But it focuses on automated decision systems. So, and there's kind of two levels to this. So first, employers cannot rely exclusively on these systems for pretty much any employment related decision at any phase of the employment life cycle. So that's sort of a prohibition on exclusive reliance. But employers are able to use these systems to help with those decisions, but to do so, they need to take steps including pre-deployment, testing, bias audits, human oversights, and training. So these are all things we've mentioned in other bills. And like I said, we're going to be seeing these terms well into the future.
And to be clear, that's just a bill that has not passed. It's not law yet.
That's correct.
And I can only imagine, you know, when the law says that employers cannot rely exclusively on those systems, but they can use the systems to help, can imagine the litigation that's going to come from there and how we're going to have to prove as employers, well, I didn't rely exclusively, I only relied in part in this percentage of my decision. That really is going to prompt a lot of litigation if this does pass.
I think it could. And I think one of the other issues with just the way that this framework is that, you know, compare this to the EU AI Act, right, where you have what I mentioned before is a sort of a holistic approach to all things employment law as a high risk system. Now, I'm not sure that's the answer, but what I am somewhat concerned about just as an employment lawyer is having all these different laws for all these different use cases. And the use cases are always going to outpace the law, right? So how will they ever catch up? And is it just going to be an avalanche of different laws coming down? So we'll see. There's one more bill I'd like to mention, Mike. It's the Algorithmic Accountability Act. Mm-hmm. And that is one that would regulate how employers use AI to make employment decisions. So again, once again, employers would have to be conducting impact assessments, bias auditing, and ongoing training and education for all the staff that would be involved in you know, using them for decision-making purposes.
All right. So we've gotten a lot here. And in the time that we've spent in this episode, we've thrown a lot of information out there. If I'm an employer and I'm sitting here slightly confused by all of this, but knowing I need to do something, give us some takeaways, if you would. What are some action items that an employer should take back to their organization to think about and implement when it comes to the use of AI and when it comes to their particular workforce?
Sure, that's a great question because it's really easy to get disoriented right now. And as important as AI is, we both know that employers have plenty of other things to focus on. So I think as a first step, it's really important to just understand your company's relationship with AI. And that's how is your company using AI officially and unofficially? So you want, you know, if you have employees going on to ChatGPT, you want to know that at this point. So, but you also want to know what the official, you know, the approved AI usages are. What are the models? What are the systems that your company's using? And not only your company, but your contractors, right? Because we talked about how the EU AI Act especially could impact us if we're just in the supply chain. What's the AI being used for? So the reason that's important to understand is because of these risk-based classification systems. And then again, the territorial scope of the AI use. So where is it affecting people? Because again, that is something that we need to look at in the EU AI Act. So very basic questions about just understanding how your company's using AI. And then once you have that, you want to understand which laws are going to apply to your company's AI usage. And this is one of the harder parts, but if your company is operating in the EU or is part of that supply chain, you really need to evaluate your obligations under that act. Or if you're a government contractor in the US, you really, you know, if you understand that OMB memo, that could really pay dividends for your company in the future because you could be in a position to align yourself with what those agencies are going to be looking for. So if you're using AI in employment or any of these other high-risk purposes, then you know you're going to have to pay attention to bias auditing or impact analysis requirements. So, and that may be even just as a best practice. So you want to determine how to conduct those studies and get ahead of that. And I guess my final suggestion there would be once you know how your company's using AI and you know which laws are going to apply, then it's time to really work out a governance structure for AI usage. And a lot of companies have policies that regulate AI. And some of those like simply say, just don't put our confidential information out into the public GPT prompts, right? And that's really important, but it's probably not sufficient if the company's using AI to perform services for contractors or something of that nature. So you want your procurement, your IT, your data, your HR, and all those teams to be aligned on the specifications that your AI services are supposed to meet and how you're going to control the flow of information both into and out of the system that you're using.
That's great. All really helpful takeaways. Any good sources for employers who, other than, of course, this podcast, and some of the alerts that we as a firm at Cozen O'Connor put out, are there particular sources out there yet that folks tend to rely on to get information that's, you know, less technical? Or, you know, is there just too much stuff out there to mention any one or two in particular?
So as an employment lawyer, one of the, you know, I find that Bloomberg is doing a good job keeping up and giving me updates and really focusing on, you know, some of the legal side of this and less technical. But a lot of it is just, you know, taking the effort. There's so much out there on this. And, you know, and you don't need to have a very high level technical understanding to understand the impact that is out there. But so a lot of it is just taking that initiative and going onto Google and knowing which sources to trust, of course, and avoiding deep fakes and things of that nature. but really, you know, doing, you know, just constantly being aware of what's going on because things are moving so fast that, you know, even taking a month off, you're left in the dust.
No question about it. And we'll continue to update all of these developments here on the podcast as well. Jeff Clement, resident in our firm's Pittsburgh office, but practicing all over the place as an employment lawyer, of course, but certainly dealing with all things AI. Really appreciate you coming on and look forward to hopefully having you back on to talk more about these things as they develop.
Great, Mike. I love that. And thanks so much for the opportunity.
That was, I hope, very helpful to all of you. Things to think about, things to take back to your organizations. it does seem real overwhelming, I know, to so many people, this area of artificial intelligence generally, and then this area of what regulation, what laws, what rules apply to all of this. You don't have to tackle all of it at once, but you should be thinking about it. You should be thinking about what your employees are doing, either sanctioned by the organization when it comes to AI or on their own in ways that might affect the organization. What policies do you want to put in place? What do you need to be thinking about from a federal, a state, and a local regulatory scheme standpoint when it comes to your usage of AI or generative AI? At a minimum, the takeaway should be, let's have a conversation. Let's talk about this. Let's set up a committee to talk about it and see what the organization wants to do in these areas. And at a minimum, stay abreast. Keep your eyes and your ears open, because these topics will be fodder for discussion as we continue the days, weeks, months, and certainly years ahead. Thank you for listening, as always. I really appreciate it. And until the next time, I hope all of your labor is productive.